It's 8 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, and again the National Broadcasting Company directs its microphones to the capitals of Europe for another summary of the late developments by NBC's war reporters abroad. This morning we shall hear reports from London, an attempt to contact Bordeaux, Rome, and then the news from Washington, D.C. First, we take you to London. Go ahead, London.
This is London at 1 o'clock. You've heard Marshal Petain's broadcast. Here is a digest of what he said. French men and women, at the call of the French president, I have assumed the leadership of the government of France. I think of those who have been fighting, true to their old military traditions, against an enemy of huge numerical superiority. I also think of those old combatants whom I commanded during the last war. I have given myself to France to better her situation at this grave hour. At this moment, I think of the unfortunate refugees, the men and women on the roads who are driven away from their homes by the misfortunes of war. I express to them my sincerest sympathy and love. The battle has had to cease during the night. I have approached the enemy with a view to finding out whether he would be prepared to put an honorable end to our hostilities. At this grave hour of heavy destiny of our fatherland, let all Frenchmen gather around myself and my government in unity. In other words, the French army has stopped fighting. Editorials this afternoon are of one mind. They pay tribute to the French fighting forces and extend the deepest sympathy to France and her people. Without exception, they assume that Britain alone will continue the struggle. Britain is relatively fresh, relatively intact, except for losses in the Northern Army withdrawal. The unanimous call of all editorials is for the immediate transformation of this island into a fortress. The war in the Mediterranean area is intensified, according to reports. An official British announcement from Cairo states that Italian airports in East Africa have been successfully raided. On Saturday, the announcement says the air base at Diradawa, Abyssinia, was set on fire by incendiary bombs and that the fire spread to a nearby railway junction. Direct hits are also claimed on the Makaka Airport and on buildings near Assab in Eritrea. A frontier post is said to have been bombed and machine gunned by an RAF plane at Elwak during a reconnaissance over the Kenya-Somaliland frontier. At the same time, an official communique issued from the British Middle East headquarters stated that Italian naval units and planes attacked Sulam on the Gulf of Sulam near the Libyan border, wounding two officers and 20 men of the Egyptian Frontier Force, whose barracks and stores were also damaged. Eight civilian casualties, the communique adds, were caused by an Italian air raid on Sidi Barani, 50 miles east of Sulam. A spokesman of the British Foreign Office said here 5 minutes ago that the decision of France to give up the fight in no way alters Britain's decision to continue the war. We shall fight alone if necessary, he said, and we shall win alone. The British papers are now talking much of the French Navy, or were this morning. Until the last few days, there's been little mention about the naval units across the Channel. But it is now being stressed in official quarters that even if it is impossible for France to continue the war on her own territory, she can still contribute to the British war effort by taking her part in the blockade of Germany. That comment seems now to be pointless. We return you now to the National Broadcasting Company, New York.
And that's the report from London this morning. We've just had a call from Bordeaux, France. And so for the continuation of our news summary, we take you to Bordeaux.
France ambassador is charged with carrying on negotiations between the new French government and Germany. This is Archinon in Bordeaux, returning you to NBC New York.
Due to conflicting reports this morning, we were unable to establish contact in time for the Bordeaux summary, and so we take you now to Rome.
Hello, NBC. This is Charles Lanius in Italy. Well, here in Rome, it looks extremely bad for France. The formation of the new French cabinet at Bordeaux at dawn today is regarded by observers here as the beginning of a quick end. These observers expect peace overtures from the new French government any time now. They may come in a few days or in a few hours from now. But in all events, demands for a separate peace will come quickly according to these sources. The Nazis haven't given the French nation a breathing space to reorganize, it is pointed out. Italy's attack on southeastern France, in Africa, and in the Mediterranean has made the German job half as easy, they say. The Italian intervention definitely decided the issue, these same observers insist. Especially pleasing to certain circles in Rome is the inclusion of Pierre Laval in the new Papin Weygand setup. Laval is the new Minister of Justice. That position in itself doesn't usually draw much water in ordinary French government. But this time, the job, with Laval in it, assumes far greater importance, particularly in Italian eyes. Laval, as you know, is considered the one French politician who has the knack of handling himself well when he is taking part in diplomatic dealings with Italians. It was he, as you will remember, during the early part of the Italo-Abyssinian War, suggested with Sir Samuel Hoare the ill-fated Hoare-Laval peace plan, which, at the time, might have been acceptable to the Italian government. That plan, you know, which was thrown into discard because British and French public opinion wouldn't stand for it, would have stood up Abyssinia, with Italy getting a nice, big, fat slice for herself. That plan, it is believed by many Italians, and many foreign experts as well, might have changed the entire complexion of present-day events had it been pushed through and accepted. Instead, the Allies came up with sanctions. The political events which followed, leading up to the present war, came in logical order, as sure as arithmetic, these Rome observers point out. Laval and the French government, again, means that France is prepared to recognize Italian claims, they say. Well, France is pictured here as a disordered, panic-stricken, beaten country, with her people fleeing in terror before the invader. A second Poland, so to speak. The Rome radio reports today that while German troops press southward at fantastic speed, thousands of French soldiers and civilians are at the Swiss frontier clamoring for entry. According to the report, the Swiss government has called up two army classes to keep them out. Those French who do manage to get over into the frontier are promptly slapped into concentration camps, it is said. Then, too, the bonded Maginot Line is considered here as useless as a junk pile, now that the Germans have caught the French from behind. And now here's the sixth Italian war bulletin just issued, and I quote, "Yesterday, our aviation again bombarded naval and air bases at Malta, in Corsica, and Tunisia. One British fighter was brought down in a dogfight. The enemy air force limited itself to only a few raids over Italy, nearly always by single airplanes, which dropped bombs on cities and open country, especially at night. One civilian was killed and several injured at Savona. At Cagliari, the raid damaged hangars at the airfield. Six Air Force soldiers were killed and about 30 were wounded. At Palermo, when defending fighters took off, an enemy formation flew off, giving up the attack." The bulletin indicates increasing activity of reconnaissance elements in the Alps. In North Africa, it says, land, air, and naval actions against English forces are in full development with favorable results. The bulletin continues. In East Africa, there was great activity against air and naval bases at Sudan and Kenya. Some enemy planes were destroyed on the ground and buildings damaged. Raids by the enemy caused small damage to the railroad at Deir Daoud, which incidentally is halfway between Djibouti and Addis Abeba. And that's all of the war communique today. Now, here's a little American sidelight on the war. In Rome, there's been a run on American flag lapel emblems. You know the kind, the little enameled United States flags, the ones that can be slipped into coat buttonholes. Now that there's an unofficial ban on speaking French, and even English is frowned on by some Italians, it's a little difficult for Americans who can't speak Italian fluently. And of course, that takes in about all of them here. So Americans in Rome decided that a little American flag in the coat buttonhole would help a lot. Well, it evidently works all right, because there's been no instance of any kind reported. But today, when I tried at a half a dozen stores to buy a buttonhole flag for myself, I found the stock was entirely sold out. This is Charles Lanius in Rome. I now return you to National Broadcasting Company in New York.
This is NBC in New York. And now for the news in our own country, we turn to Earl Godwin, reporting from the NBC newsroom in Washington.
Good morning. Washington wakes up tense. It's 10 minutes past 7 in Washington, News from Europe has already stunned President Roosevelt, members of the State Department, members of the Cabinet, and early morning congressmen who get out and take a walk and listen to the radio. But everyone withholds comment until complete details of the rapid action in France comes from abroad. President Roosevelt, rather tired from last week's strenuous duties, went down the river on his own yacht Saturday and Sunday. He did not hear of the French crisis until he returned to the city last night after that cruise. And the French ambassador to America, Count René de Saint-Quentin, knew nothing at all about the downfall of his own government until he received a call from a newspaper man. The usually active diplomatic communication wires have been disrupted, and official Washington is dependent on newspapers, press associations, and radio reports for European developments. Of course, Washington has Congress before it. Legislative action goes on as usual. The great $5 billion defense program and things leading up to it are not all finished at the Capitol. And with intense speed, the work of passing the remaining bills is going on, starting at noon again today. Of course, their last-minute efforts are going to be made to clean up some of the pending legislation, because Congress has got to decide a rather minor matter, whether it will adjourn or take a recess this week before the Republican National Convention opens in Philadelphia next Monday, or will Congress remain in session indefinitely? The Senate has nearly completed action on the President's $5 billion defense program. Today it opens debate on a measure which has already been passed by the House, that tax bill which is designed to pay merely for a part of the defense output. And when I say a part, remember that the tax bill is for $1 billion to be raised in 1 year. The entire cost of the defense program as appropriated for this 1 year is $5 billion. In other words, the way the tax bill is now written, it will take five of these tax years to pay one of these defense years. However, on the House side, the calendar is practically clear. I think it ought to be known, for the glory of the House leadership, that the House of Representatives started off with a schedule to accomplish certain things legislatively, to pass certain appropriation bills and other bills, and it scheduled it week by week. And under the able leadership of Sam Rayburn of Texas, the majority leader, the Speaker, Mr. Bankhead of Alabama, and of course the cooperation of the minority through its leader, Joe Martin of Texas, the House of Representatives in this Congress has actually kept up to the schedule that it set when it convened. Now, many of the leaders want to go home. However, the rank and file of Congress think they ought to stay there, and the leaders are pessimistic about prospects of adjournment because, actually, the folks at home want Congress to stand by. Senate Democratic Leader Barkley, however, thinks that Congress should quit and go home. The President thinks that Congress should quit and go home because the rest of Congress says the President will be nothing but speech-making. I paraphrase the gentleman. The administration campaign against fifth columnists continues. Representative Howard Smith of Virginia is seeking quick passage of the Senate changes in his alien control bill.
That's the report from Earl Godwin in Washington this morning. This is NBC New York, and here's a summation of this morning's big news. We will cease to fight. Those were the dramatic words this morning of French Premier Pétain. I am moved by compassion for the nation's refugees, says France's new Premier Marshal Pétain as he addressed the French nation starting at 7:30 New York time. Marshal Pétain said that he was compelled to make the announcement and that he did so only with a heavy heart. The battle has had to cease during the night, the marshal continued. I have approached the enemy with a view to finding out whether he would put an honorable end to the hostilities. At this grave hour of heavy destiny of our fatherland, let all Frenchmen gather around myself and my government in unity. And so concludes another summary of news from abroad and home, and this is the National Broadcasting Company. In It's 1:30 Eastern Daylight Saving Time. Time for the latest news from the NBC newsroom. Interpreted by the noted analyst, Mr. H.V. Kaltenborn.
Good afternoon, everybody. When a shattering crisis comes into the life of an individual, of a nation, or of the world in which we live, the first duty is to be realistic concerning that crisis, to face the facts. France has surrendered. And remember that that means all of France, the French Empire, the French fleet, the French Air Force, the French Army. The conditions of the surrender have not yet been written. They have been asked for, and they have been asked of two dictators who have never exemplified generosity or mercy in their policy. Therefore, we must realize that the conditions of that surrender will be hard. Could hard conditions be resisted? I think not. On the basis of every fair estimate of the French military situation for the past week, continuing the fight was hopeless. I said that almost a week ago, and have had to repeat it on the basis of successive war bulletins ever since. It is true that fighting is still going on in various parts of France, but it is fighting by separated, disorganized forces who have absolutely no chance for any effective continuing of resistance. Just glancing at the German communique this morning, telling of the capture of Orléans, the crossing of the Loire, motorized troops reaching the border of Switzerland behind the Maginot Line, all that indicates very definitely that so far as land fighting in France is concerned, the end has come. And so, Pétain, on the basis of those facts, appeals as the president of the present French government, assumes the direction of the government of France, and then makes that memorable speech which some of you heard this morning, which I heard over NBC's network. I am in heart and thought with our admirable army. I am thinking of those old fighters whom I commanded in the last war. I am thinking of the unfortunate refugees, men and women on the roads who have been driven away from their homes by the misfortunes of war. I have applied to our opponent to ask him if he is ready to sign with us as between soldiers after the fight and in honor means to put an end to hostilities. And the 84-year-old leader of France in her time of travail continues and concludes, let all Frenchmen group themselves around the government wherever I preside during this painful trial and affirm once more their faith in the destiny of our country. That means Frenchmen in Africa, Frenchmen in Asia, Frenchmen of the fleet and of the Air Force and of the Empire. It is a complete cessation of belligerence, which Pétain announces. There is an appeal to Hitler for an honorable end to hostilities, but there is no statement as to further military action anywhere if Hitler, Mussolini, and Pétain do not see eye to eye as to what in honor means. The following communique was issued at headquarters of Adolf Hitler. Marshal Pétain, premier of the newly formed French government, declared by radio to the French people that France must now lay down her arms. In this speech, he pointed out that steps ought to be taken, informing the Reich government of this decision and requesting information on conditions under which the Reich would be prepared to accede to French desires. The Führer will meet with the Italian prime minister to discuss the attitudes of the two states. My guess is that they will meet in Paris. That appeals to the vanity of dictators. It appeals to the Nazi sense of the dramatic. It appeals to those who have in mind the humiliation which Germany suffered at Paris and at Versailles. And so we must expect that Hitler and Mussolini and Pétain will be together in Paris, perhaps within 24, perhaps within 48 hours, to consider the terms of the French surrender. What of the British? The official British Press Association said today that the entire British Empire is unshakably determined to continue the fight. Yes, undoubtedly that's true. Britain must continue the fight. But let's be frank. Britain can't hope to defeat the present combination of Nazi Germany plus fascist Italy plus the resources of France and Holland and Belgium and Norway and Sweden and Denmark and all of the Balkan states, for they are all at this moment vassals of the Berlin-Rome axis. And I might almost be willing to include Soviet Russia, for there is no military strength in Soviet Russia that could match the Nazi war machine at its present high peak of efficiency. When you remember that it will gain immeasurable, immediate resources in the large area of France that has not in any sense been devastated by war, and that is rich with the exact resources that are needed for continued war. Britain hopes, as this press association statement indicates, that France will not place all her resources outside the mother country at the disposal of her war ally. Well, what can France, insofar as the Pétain government is concerned, do? The Pétain government must yield to Hitler's terms. The only question is, what will the fleet do? Will they surrender their ships, or will they sink them, or will they turn them over to the British? What will the airmen do? Will they destroy their planes? Will they surrender them, or will they turn them over to Britain for further fighting? That's the question that will be settled also within the next 48 fateful hours, and perhaps the decision has already been made by the men in whose power it is to make it. Now, of course, Hitler and Mussolini will make every concession to France depend upon France's repudiation of Britain and the surrender of the fleet and the surrender of the empire. Dictators tolerate no halfway measures. And what's Pétain going to do? He'll have to use all his power and all his influence with the fleet and with the Air Force and with the empire to get them to accede to Hitler's and Mussolini's terms. And they may respond to the appeal of this 84-year-old leader of France, for he may say to them, your country, your motherland, will have to suffer the most humiliating parceling out between Italy and Germany unless you agree to the decision which I, who am helpless, am obliged to make. That's the thing to remember when you think of the possibility of terms of one kind or another. Here's what the Italian press says. It expresses pity for vanquished France. The Giornale d'Italia headlined the news from France as a French revolt against England. Note the emphasis on the anti-British stand. That's the note that Hitler and Mussolini have been trying to enforce in France since the beginning of the war. And believe me that with complete control of propaganda now in France, they'll go far with that particular type of appeal. For when you've lost something, you're looking for someone to blame for that loss outside of yourself. That's your only psychological salvation, and that will be the psychological salvation of the people of France. So, we know now that every effort of the Rome-Berlin axis will be devoted to securing all of France's resources for the finished fight against the British Empire. They may make concessions to France to secure this end. They have achieved the object which Hitler tried hard to get without fighting, a separate peace, and their next effort will be to take over French resources intact. Hungary congratulates Hitler. Premier Count Tiriki, in a speech to his parliament, congratulated Hitler on the German victory, which, he said, confirmed Hungarians' belief that justice must prevail. In other words, Hungary says, we who fought with you, Germany, in the last war, now give us that peace of Romania, that peace of Yugoslavia, to which we are entitled, as you yourself have said. And he denounced the treatment Hungary received at Allied hands after the World War. And who that is fair or dispassionate in his estimate of the events following the war is not sure that Hungary was wronged, deeply wronged. And Russia marches into Lithuania, into Latvia, into Estonia this morning with tanks and troops, with the idea of solidifying her position there so that she will not at least be helpless against the German onslaught if and when it comes. But don't expect Soviet Russia to take any military action against Nazi Germany. She is far from thinking of anything of the kind. She might even place herself at the more complete disposition of the Axis now that its triumph over France has been completed. There'll be wishful thinking with reference to Soviet Russia. But Stalin is realistic. He's not going to help the Allies or what's left of the Allies against the triumphant Rome-Berlin Axis. He's only going to try to get his piece of the loot. That's what he's tried to do since the beginning. That's what he's doing in marching his troops into the Baltic countries today. That's what he'll continue to do. And when it comes to the division in the Balkans, he too wants to share whatever division is made. In Washington, the immediate reaction by the White House is a meeting of the Secretaries of State, Treasury, Agriculture, Commerce to conclude the study of the research which has been undertaken during recent months into the most effective manner of disposing profitably of export surpluses in the Western Hemisphere. I'm reading a statement that Mr. Early gave out a couple of hours ago. This study will include the investigation of the problems that affects the American republics, as well as such other countries as may be confronting a similar situation and as may desire to join with the American nations in an efficacious solution of it. That's a lot of words. What it means is that we're going to try to set up with the 20-odd republics of Latin America a general selling and buying agency. That is, if we can persuade them to go along with us on that. That will be the test. Perhaps we've been fooling ourselves as to Pan-American solidarity. All right, let's ask them to make sacrifices in order to create a solid economic unit in the new world, that we may oppose the forces from the old, which may soon be reaching across the Atlantic. Let's see how they react to that suggestion. It hasn't yet been put into concrete form. When it is put into that form and is transmitted to them, then their reaction will tell us as to whether they're more interested in good terms with a victorious Rome-Berlin Axis or with democracy and those two great powers in the world that still represent democracy. France was defeated, said Colonel Johnson, Assistant Secretary of War today, because she tried to fight the war with horses and mules and other types of equipment contemporary with 1917. Consider what Germany has done, he said. She put her equipment and her manpower on wheels and utilized the most devastating thing ever created, the airplane. France found that with German superiority in the air, photographs of the terrain could be made every hour so that progressive movements below could be compared. Often photographs have been developed in the observation planes, and word was then sent to attack groups on the ground. That's the story of the defeat of the French. Yes, and Mr. Johnson might have mentioned also industrial organization, for that's something that we think we have, but we haven't got it. Not for defense. We've got it for profit, yes. We've got it for flooding the world with mechanized materials, yes, but we haven't got it coordinated and organized so that it serves the fundamental purpose of defense. And now, it's understood in Washington that Britain will take over France's war orders. It's understood, too, that the United States will go on helping what's left of the Allies. But how? And what are we going to do about this vast territory now in all the world that suddenly comes under control of the Rome-Berlin Axis against which a blockade has been declared by Britain? It's going to be a real test of statesmanship for us to take action in the face of the entirely new situation which the world confronts as a result of the brief statement made in an almost quavering voice by the 84-year-old leader of unhappy France. Good afternoon.
Mr. Kaltenborn will be heard again over many of these stations at 1:30 tomorrow. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
It's 10 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, and here in the NBC newsroom in New York is Mr. T.R. Ibarra, noted foreign correspondent, ready to bring you his nightly review of the day's news. During the course of Mr. Ibarra's broadcast, our engineers will be listening for Bordeaux. Some of our listeners may have heard our NBC reporter in the temporary French capital schedule a report for 5 minutes past 10 p.m. Eastern Daylight Saving Time in his earlier broadcast today. So as soon as we hear Bordeaux, we'll interrupt Mr. Ibarra and switch you to our reporter in that city. All right, Mr. T.R. Ibarra.
125 years ago today, on the 18th of June, 1915, the Battle of Waterloo was fought. On that celebrated Belgian battlefield, the France of Napoleon Bonaparte met final and crushing defeat. On this 18th of June, 1940, Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini, the victorious dictators of Berlin and Rome, are meeting in Munich to decide on the terms of peace to be offered to the France of 1940. That France has just been vanquished by Hitler in a series of battles of a scope, fury, and significance that dwarfed the great battle of 125 years ago. And there is excellent reason for assuming tonight that the terms about to be offered by Hitler and Mussolini to the beaten French government will be infinitely harsher than those imposed by the victors of Waterloo on the France of 1815. Of course, everything written tonight as to the exact nature of the peace conditions of the German and Italian dictators runs up against a rock. That rock is the fact that nobody is in a position to say just what those conditions will be, no matter how gaudily ignorance is dressed up to resemble knowledge. It is possible that Hitler and Mussolini themselves have not reached final decision. There may still be points on which further discussion and bargaining between them will be necessary. Nevertheless, in spite of the fog enveloping the Brown House at Munich, sacred headquarters of Nazism, where Der Führer Neil Ducci met today, all signs point to the probability that the peace cooked up by them will be a peace of vengeance. Even if Hitler wanted to be magnanimous, and he has given no clear signs of any such desire, he would find immense obstacles in his path. In Germany, millions of Germans are wild for revenge. These irreconcilable Teutons have not forgotten the shattering victory of the Allies over Germany in the World War. They remember the crushing clauses of the Treaty of Versailles, imposed upon Germany in 1919 after the collapse of the Kaiser's armies in 1918. All those Germans remember the famous sleeping car of Compiègne. In that car, Marshal Foch placed before Germany's special envoys the hard terms upon which he was willing to accept an armistice. All these things German diehards remember, and there is practically no reason why Hitler should not be classed among those diehards. The Führer has been shouting for years that his mission is to obliterate every vestige of the Europe created by the Treaty of Versailles. Tonight, after weeks of victories over French armies that have left France prostrate at Nazi Germany's feet, it seems incredible that the nemesis of Versailles should suddenly turn into a lamb of forgiveness and mercy. Moreover, Benito Mussolini sits at Adolf Hitler's elbow tonight. Ever since Il Duce seized power, he has bitterly lamented the fact that fascist Italy is, to use his own expressive phrase, the prisoner of the Mediterranean. Only by the defeat of France and Britain can Mussolini drastically alter the Mediterranean situation. Britain, of course, remains to be pushed out of his way, but France has been struck down. It simply doesn't make sense to visualize Mussolini as eating the words of scores of his fiery speeches. One cannot see Il Duce foregoing the opportunity of driving away the French from the vantage points that have enabled France up to now to make the Mediterranean a prison for Italians. Hitler, one may reasonably guess, will insist on reducing his French foes to military impotence. The Nazi dictator will probably also demand that France turn over the French navy to those who have just vanquished her, a demand in which he will be vigorously seconded by Mussolini. Whether the French fleet will let itself be caught by Germany and Italy is another matter. Hitler will also probably seek to impose a heavy indemnity on stricken France. As to territorial demands, he will doubtless seek to recover for Germany Alsace and Lorraine, taken from France by Germany in 1871 and from Germany by France in 1919. As for colonies, the Nazis will doubtless try to snatch from France all German colonial possessions wrested by the French from the Germans after the World War, and more French colonies besides. All these demands would be in the true Versailles manner. Just to make them even more bitter to the French, they may be imposed on the vanquished French Republic at Versailles itself, possibly with a preliminary armistice signed at Compiègne, possibly in the very sleeping car, preserved there as a sacred French shrine.
Excuse us, Mr. Ibarra. I think we have our signal from Bordeaux. Let's try it overseas to Bordeaux.
Calling NBC New York. Bordeaux. Calling NBC New York. Bordeaux. Calling NBC New York.
This is John Lloyd of the Associated Press talking. The Associated Press Emergency Bureau at Bordeaux sent a dispatch during the day saying the French government was awaiting an answer to Marshal Pétain's request for an Arable peace. At 3 o'clock in the morning, our time here in Bordeaux, there was still no news of a reply. It may be a matter of only hours, and it may be days. In the meantime, until an agreement has been reached, the French troops are continuing their resistance. In Bordeaux, whose population has been swelled to proportion out of all relation with facilities, thousands of people are sleeping in their cars, parked in squares, on the streets, on lots. Most of these people have trekked hundreds of miles. The cars are crammed with personal belongings. The sleepers squeeze in wherever they can. In the daytime, the sidewalks are so jammed, many have to walk in the streets. Traffic is so heavy that it's almost impossible to pass by cars from one part of the city to another. Yet, in this almost incredible situation, there has been no sign of disorder. People are taking it well, all things considered. All British soldiers, except a few stragglers, have now left. This includes newspaper men and diplomats. There is both a large representation of American newspaper correspondents here, most of whom probably will stay on for whatever happens. And Ambassador Bitter is remaining in contact with the government. Embassy Secretaries Freeman Masters and Douglas MacArthur Jr. are also here. Captain John Sterling, the air attaché, and Captain Robert Scow, acting military attaché, are also on the job. They are all sorts at the American consulate, which has a huge American flag outside. The embassy attaché, like the newspaper men, moved with the government from Paris to Tours. Then they came on here. Tours was like Bordeaux, teeming with huge crowds of refugees. It was almost as hard there as it is here to find a place to sleep and find a restaurant where you could get something to eat. I recall one day at Tours when Captain Stone, Captain Sterling, and my AP colleague, Bill McGaffin, and I were turned away for other restaurant we visited in Tours. Everywhere it was the same story. Nothing left to eat. Finally, we bought ourselves some bread and cheese and ordered at a table in a crowded cafe. This is the kind of gypsy life. You move on from one spot to another, constantly going. That is, constantly since we left town. Perhaps this is the last stop. Everybody has been dependent on cars. Relics that you would never imagine could run are to be seen on the packed and jammed roads. Whole families are heaped into them. Families that have come perhaps from Belgium, perhaps from Paris, perhaps only from Tours. They're really distressing, isn't it? One woman came into our office today and said she had to get to the Spanish border. She thought it meant her life if she didn't get out. She had a brand new car, but she couldn't drive. She would give us the car at the border, she said. If only some one of us would drive her down. We couldn't help her. She trudged on out, red-eyed, and I don't know whether she found the driver or not. My fellow IP correspondents and I took turns sleeping in our two cars for the first couple of nights. We finally got a room, and our sleeping room by relay. There was an alert last night, and some had an aircraft fire, but no bombs were heard. It was my first night in the room, and Taylor Henry, who shared it with me, on this, the second relay, was as tired as I. The siren sounded, but we went all off to sleep. That sounds like not the thing a newspaper correspondent should do, but you don't know how tired we were. And besides, the AP correspondent Bill Humphrey was staying up to cover. Well, that is it, Brian. Here we are. Here we will stay so long as there is news. When there isn't any anymore, we'll move on to where it all is. Good night.
Back in the NBC newsroom in New York, after we returned from overseas and from a report on the war situation from Bordeaux by John Lloyd, member of the Associated Press Emergency Bureau in the temporary French capital. We had interrupted Mr. T.R. Ibarra in his comments on the war situation to go overseas for this broadcast from Bordeaux, and perhaps you might be interested to know in passing that we weren't any too sure that we would have it, but that an earlier broadcast by our NBC reporter, Paul Archinard, this afternoon indicated he hoped to be on from Bordeaux at this time. Due to the temporary nature of our communications overseas, we are unable to give them a signal when to go ahead, so we switched over, hopefully, and we were grateful to receive the broadcast from Mr. Lloyd. And now I return to Mr. Ibarra here in the NBC newsroom.
Hints come out of Europe tonight that France is by no means done for. Certain omens in the dark skies over Europe make it appear that the French are not yet out of the ring in the European war, despite the awful catastrophe that has overwhelmed their armies during the past 6 weeks. First, there is always the chance that the peace terms offered by Hitler and Mussolini to Marshal Pétain, head of France's government of capitulation, will be so hard as to make acceptance impossible. Pétain is on record as desiring a peace without dishonor. The old hero of Verdun may spurn another Versailles. That would make the war go on in France. Second, bellicose Prime Minister Winston Churchill of Britain spoke today in the House of Commons as if France might again be found fighting beside the British. Churchill's speech was in the nature of a warning to all Frenchmen who wish to give up. France's government, said Churchill, will be throwing away great opportunities and casting away their future if they do not continue the war in accordance with their treaty obligations, from which we have not felt able to release them. Churchill pointed out that a number of countries overrun by the Germans have never accepted Nazi conquest, that they maintain their legally constituted governments on foreign soil. Among these, Churchill included Czechoslovakia, Poland, Norway, Holland, and Belgium. If final victory rewards our trials, the fiery Englishman continued, France will share in the gains and freedom will be restored to all. If we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, and all we have known and cared for will sink into the abyss of a new dark age. That was certainly a strong hint to France. Third, there are elements in France which disapprove of the policy of surrender adopted when Marshal Pétain replaced Monsieur Reynaud as head of the French government. Reynaud said a few days ago that the French government might be transferred to some French colony from which the fight against Germany might be continued. Such a step is still a possibility, though a slender one. If such a French government in exile should be set up, it would doubtless claim to be the only legal French government. It would doubtless disavow surrender to Germany by any other French government, and thus strip from such a surrender the semblance of legality. There may be something behind these hints out of Europe tonight, but it must be stated right away that they carry little reassurance. France, after all, has just taken a terrible beating. When General Wagon became commander-in-chief of the Allied armies in France, after the French situation had become almost desperate, he immediately had a close friend of his, which is equivalent to saying a military man of high efficiency, made head of the French military cabinet in the now-defunct Reynaud government of France. That man was General de Gaulle. Tonight, de Gaulle joins the ranks of those Frenchmen who refuse to give up hope of further resistance.
Thank you, Mr. Ibarra. T.R. Ibarra, noted foreign correspondent in a review of today's news, and also a newscast by NBC's war reporter in Bordeaux. More news on WJZ. This is the National Broadcasting Company.